Good afternoon, and welcome to the November meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Midcoast, Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name's Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum. Since 1985, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answering questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own rights. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, the Midcoast Forum is delighted to present Seth Jones. He's going to be talking about a recent new book that he's come out with, Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11. Seth is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. He most recently served as a representative for the commander at U.S. Special Operations Command to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations. Before that, he served as a plans officer and advisor to the commanding general, U.S. Special Operations Forces, in Afghanistan. So he specializes in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, with a particular focus on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Al-Qaeda. And I think it's worth emphasizing and pointing out that he was also a graduate of Maine's own Bowdoin College. So we're delighted to have Seth here with us. A warm welcome, please.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Mac, for the introduction. Thank you, Kathy, for the invitation. And thank you, everybody, for showing up on a beautiful day in Maine. As Mac noted, I did go to Bowdoin College and then went off after that to get my PhD at the University of Chicago, where the motto of many of the students, and they wear T-shirts along these lines, on the front it says University of Chicago, and on the back it says, where fun comes to die. I can't say I can relate to that from the coast of Maine, but it was that's what a winter in Chicago does to you, I think. What I'd like to do is provide you, this book actually doesn't come out until the spring of next year, so you're getting an inside peek at the book. What I'd like to do is ask two questions today. The first one is, and I'll go through these in more detail, what has contributed since 1988 to the wave patterns that I'll outline against Al-Qaeda? When you actually look at Al-Qaeda's role over the past 2.5 decades, what you actually see is not a linear movement, but a movement that has gone in what you might call waves. They have strengthened, conducted a range of attacks, and then have been weakened with arrests. Then they've resurged over time, and then they've come back down, and they've resurged again. So one question is, what factors have contributed to these changing patterns? And what does this mean for the possibility of a fourth wave as we look out over the next 5 to 10 years? That's what I'll focus on. I'll tell you where the origins of the book really came from, though, and that is when I was, at one point, about a year ago, I was with my boss at the time, Mike Vickers, who was a former CIA officer and was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations. We were on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, looking across the border into Pakistani territory, but we were on the Afghan side. And for those who haven't spent a lot of time in this general theater, there is a lot of interesting stuff that goes on. Part of what I wanted to do is to tell some of the tale over the past decade, 2 decades, of some of the efforts by some of the more clandestine covert agencies and what has been done against Al-Qaeda, because I think some of that has not been appreciated, when in fact I would say most of the more successful efforts against Al-Qaeda have generally come from clandestine agencies. In terms of getting adequate information publicly releasable, we had to turn to court trials, which have, when you prosecute somebody in a U.S. court, that information is public. And when, in several of the cases, the more high-profile individuals, when they admit to their activity and explain it in court the way we've had, and I'll walk through some of the more recent cases, it's public domain. So part of the information that we've been able to gather and use in footnotes has come from court trials, both in the United States and in several countries outside. So the British, for example, with the London attacks and several of the more serious plots, and then in Madrid. That's where the bulk of the information comes out. There's actually a startling amount of information that's certainly publicly available. What I'd like to do, though, before getting into this, is give you at least my perspective of what Al-Qaeda looks like today. Is this microphone on? Can you hear me okay if I move around a little bit? Yeah. Okay. If you can't hear me, just let me know. What I'd like to do for a moment is, sorry, I may, if I walk back and forth, then you have to turn. Mac, I apologize. Al-Qaeda today, at least in my view, is very different from the organization that existed in 2001 when it hit New York City. I would say it's composed of roughly five what you might call tiers. At the center is the core tier, central Al-Qaeda, that still remains in Pakistan. It now is headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, an Egyptian, but has a senior command and control element that still exists in Pakistan. Part of it along the tribal area, along the Afghan-Pakistan tribal areas, but part of it is deeper, as we've seen with the bin Laden raid, part of it is deeper inside of Pakistan. For our interests here in the United States, it has several individuals that are either American citizens or that have spent considerable time in the United States. This is important because these are individuals that are still planning operations in the United States and would certainly like to conduct targets in the U.S. homeland. They include, for example, Adam Gadan, who's a senior, who's now sort of a senior propaganda individual, who's risen up the ranks. He was born and raised in the Orange County area of California. Actually, what's interesting about Adam Gadan is his father, he's an Al-Qaeda member now, his father is Jewish. His mother is Christian. He was raised in a Christian household in a goat farm, got interested in heavy metal music, actually death metal music, and then converted to Islam, was recruited in Southern California before 9/11, radicalized, and now is a fairly senior member, not at the top, but is an American citizen. Adnan al-Shukr Juma has been involved most recently in the 2009 plot in New York City, which I'll come to a little bit later, and a range of other Americans that are actually operating from different organizations. So that's your central Al-Qaeda. Now, like any good business, the organization still is divided into a range of committees to function. It's got a religious committee, or shura. It has a financial committee, or shura, which raises money, especially from Gulf areas. It has a military committee that is involved in its multiple fronts overseas, training, including training camps and external operations, including plots against the U.S. homeland. So that core Al-Qaeda does exist. Its role is different from 2001. We'll come back to that in a minute. But that's your inner circle. Second, outside of that, is the affiliates, the primary affiliates. And Al-Qaeda's affiliates now tend to be still primarily in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That affiliate was seriously weakened after the Anbar awakening around 2006 and 2007 in Iraq. But interestingly, we'll see with the downsizing of American forces in Iraq, there have been some recent U.S. intelligence concerns about a revival of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's one major affiliate. We have probably the most dangerous Al-Qaeda affiliate for the homeland now, which is the Arabian Peninsula, based out of Yemen. They really began to increase their activities about 2009 under the direction of a Yemeni named Wahishi, who had been imprisoned in Iran for some period of time, that was transferred to Yemen and escaped, and supported by a range of Americans, including Anwar al-Awlaki, who was born in New Mexico, was recently killed from a drone strike. But that Yemen branch is actually quite significant. There are a range of current activities right now to conduct attacks using body cavity bombs and a range of other what I would call sort of interesting research projects to be able to get a bomb on an airplane into the United States homeland. You also have a range of other affiliates. We've seen affiliates pop up across North Africa and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Somalia with the group now, it's called Al-Shabaab, clear associations between Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda in Yemen and even Al-Qaeda back in Pakistan. So we've got a range. If you were to actually look at a map, what's interesting is if you go back to one of the major caliphates after the Prophet Muhammad died, you would look at like the Umayyad caliphate. Al-Qaeda has established its key areas now roughly in that general area. So in the North Africa front, it's got an affiliate. In the Arabian Peninsula, it's got an affiliate. In what's called Mesopotamia, in Iraq, it's got an affiliate. And in South Asia, it's got an affiliate. That's a very purposeful location of its resources so that it can overthrow those multiple regimes and establish its version of Sharia law in those areas. But it's a very clear strategic decision on where to set up its shop. And as we'll see, the arguments that have come from some U.S. government officials about Al-Qaeda is on the verge of strategic defeat, I'm going to strongly argue that while that core is weakened, I do not believe, A, it is on the verge of strategic defeat, but B, I think the question is, what would it cause that organization to gain another wave? So if that center is the Al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan, then you have affiliates. What's interesting is the third tier here, which I'll call the Al-Qaeda Allies. These are groups that don't call themselves Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but they're groups that will occasionally conduct attacks or training or pull in resources with Al-Qaeda. They include now, we've seen Lashkar-e-Taiba, which operates out of Pakistan, groups like the Tariq-e-Taliban Pakistan, which conducted the attempted attack in Times Square back in 2010, led by Faisal Shahzad. Several of these groups have become somewhat dangerous. We've seen Lashkar-e-Taiba move from an organization that is generally parochial, interested in targeting India, now to potentially interested in targeting the U.S. homeland or its interests abroad. Outside of that, you get a fourth tier, what I'll call the networks. These are organizations that we've seen, individuals that radicalize in various locations, but will have some direct connection to Al-Qaeda Central. I'll walk through Najibul Zazi in a moment because it's a really interesting plot from 2009. Zazi radicalized in the United States, attempted to conduct with two others, and came very close to this, suicide attacks on the New York City subway. He radicalized in a small cell in the United States, made it back to Pakistan, conducted his training, and then came back. He was not a formal member of Al-Qaeda. He was part of a more informal network. But he was able to connect directly back to the organization. We saw it with the underwear bomber back in 2009, somebody who radicalized partly in London, partly in Dubai, and then went to Yemen in search of Anwar al-Awlaki, connected to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and then came to the United States. So again, he radicalized through other networks, volunteered his services. But again, in all those first several, the first four areas, there's some general connection back to a core element. Your fifth group is the one where we've seen some interesting developments over the past two or three months, and that is your inspired network. These are individuals with no connection at all back to any Al-Qaeda, allied group, or affiliate, but are simply inspired by the message coming from Zawahiri, bin Laden, or other individuals, and who turn to violence in support of the message. but have no connection other than possibly radicalizing through, say, social media. Social media, if you look at the jihadi propaganda, has become a massive effort to recruit individuals or inspire them to conduct action through social media. Facebook, YouTube, all the various social media forums jihadists now use for getting out their propaganda message, recruiting people, and trying to gain resources. So social media, interesting, has become one key wave. What we've seen, I would say, since 2001 is the role of that inner tier. So if we think of it as sort of five tiers, that inner circle, the role of that organization, especially since bin Laden's death, has become less important. It's become more diffuse and more decentralized. What that means in general is that while there do appear to be messages going back and forth from organizations in the field to the core leadership in Pakistan, communications has become a lot more difficult because the U.S. intelligence apparatus has become much better at finding people, which means it's very difficult for Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's al-Qaeda's leader, to communicate. He doesn't use phone. He generally does not use the internet. He's got to use a computer where he'll write a message and then maybe save it on a thumb drive, have somebody deliver it. But all of that means that when you have a range of human and communications intercepts, and you have human sources and communications intercepts, you can ultimately trace people back, as we did with Osama bin Laden. So it's become more difficult for these individuals to communicate, which means that core element is less important. Not insignificant, but less important. And so I would say what we're seeing over the last several years is the rise of these affiliates and allied groups become of particular concern. And it does mean, among other things, that you can't cut off the head of the organization. The killing bin Laden doesn't destroy the group anymore because it's not like a pyramid. You can't cut off the head and expect to destroy the group. And we'll come back to some of these issues later. That's how I describe the organization today. It certainly is, in my view, the most dangerous threat to the United States homeland that we face. We face many other dangers that we can talk about later, but that remains, in my view, probably the one organization that is willing to pull off attacks in the U.S. homeland. We certainly will always have to deal with lone wolves in the U.S., Timothy McVeigh-type people, but in my view, that's the kind of structure of the organization. When you look back since 1988, what you find with al-Qaeda is not a linear movement. You see a series of patterns. If you were to put on a graph the number of casualties that al-Qaeda has killed, if you were to graph years on the bottom axis and on another axis you were to graph the number of people that they've killed, what you'll see is three major waves. The first one begins to pick up around 1998 with the U.S. embassy bombings, continues to increase with the USS Cole attack in Yemen, and then skyrockets in 2001 with the September 11th attacks. Then it dips pretty significantly. By about 2003, it starts to rise again with a large number of attacks in multiple different countries, and then dips about 2005, 6, and 7, but then picks up again. You see a major rise in attacks in 2008 and 2009 and 10, and then it starts to dip again. And so we're in a point now where that what I'd call third wave has begun to reverse. And so the question I'm going to pose here is, what has caused the changes, the waves and the reverse waves in al-Qaeda over the past 2.5 decades? It's a very, very important question, I would argue, because it gives us some insight into the future. What factors would likely contribute to a resurgence of the organization over the next several years? I would say at least three factors have been important in both the waves and the reversals over the past 2.5 decades, since the group was essentially formed in Peshawar in 1988. And that's how long al-Qaeda has been around in some form or other. The first factor is U.S. strategy. And I'm going to simplify this a little bit. But the U.S. has pursued what I would call two different types of strategies over the past two-plus decades. One is what you might call an overwhelming force strategy. That is to pour in large numbers of conventional forces into countries and to try and defeat terrorists by large-scale military power. So if you think of Iraq or even Afghanistan over the last several years, the U.S. has pushed in large numbers, over 100,000 in both cases, conventional forces with the primary goal of defeating al-Qaeda and trying to stabilize the country. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is what you might call a light footprint approach. And that's what we're seeing in several countries. That's what we're seeing to some degree in Yemen, certainly what we're seeing in Pakistan. It's what we saw in Afghanistan in the early years in 2001, which is predominant reliance on a low visibility footprint, covert and clandestine agencies, obviously organizations like the CIA, on the U.S. military side, special operations forces, where I come from, obviously the FBI when it comes to involvement of homeland plots. They are the ones that will arrest, especially in the United States. And then your other intelligence agencies, ones that do intercepts, National Security Agency, ones that are involved in the collection of photographs, so organizations like NGA that take satellite imagery, and so when you look at all sources of intelligence, it's those agencies, the ones that you don't see, that have played a role in that light footprint approach. So if you take a look at the Bin Laden raid in Pakistan, that was done obviously with a light footprint approach. It was done by SEALs, CIA, but it was also done with a range of other agencies that were intercepting calls, looking at the photographs of the compound, and a lot of that stuff that you won't see, but it was a light footprint approach. The capture of a range of the key al-Qaeda leaders after 9/11 in Pakistan, light footprint approach. Pakistan face on it, but a lot of U.S. Help along the way in doing it. Those are the two spectrums. And what I'll argue is we've generally seen the waves of al-Qaeda activity when the United States has pushed in large numbers of forces, especially in the Muslim lands. It tends to radicalize individuals. One of the single most significant rises in al-Qaeda activity, its second wave, was predominantly a result, I would argue, of the visibility of a large conventional presence in Iraq, which, when you look at the jihadi traffic, massively increased the jihadi traffic recruitment processes. They could point to an overt American conventional presence in a Muslim country. And I think in many ways, they were able to use it effectively to recruit people. And actually, it's not long after that that you saw your big attacks. Spanish, which were involved in the Iraq invasion and the stability after that, were attacked in 2004 in Madrid. In 2005, the British were attacked in London. The individuals, when you go through their transcripts, that were radicalized to a major degree because of the Iraq invasion. And so I'm saying, actually, regardless of whether you think it was a good or a bad thing, I think the simple fact is that it was a useful propaganda tool for al-Qaeda. 2006, we had the transatlantic plot. This is when anybody here gets on an airplane. The reason you can't bring liquids over a certain amount is because of the 2006 plot hatched in the UK. They were targeting about just under a dozen airlines coming to the United States. It was a very sophisticated plot. Went up to the top of al-Qaeda external operations, a guy by the name of Abu Ubaidah al-Masri. And in that sense, those individuals also radicalized in a great degree because of the Iraq invasion. The second issue, and one of the second factors that has contributed to these rise and falls, is al-Qaeda's own strategy. They have also been very selective at who they kill. So if you think of up through 9/11, they generally targeted U.S. and other allied government installations, embassies, boats, including the USS Cole.
And so we've seen even since then, they've targeted government officials, collaborators, and spies. That tends in general not to cause major consternation among their key support bases, generally supportive of those kinds of attacks. Where they've run into a problem is when they get involved in killing large numbers of civilians, especially for al-Qaeda, large numbers of Muslims. So what we saw, for example, is in that middle wave, they were able to take advantage of the Iraq invasion with a large U.S. presence on the ground. But by 2005, 2006, and 2007, before and then even after the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, they killed large numbers of Sunni, Shia, and in general other civilians, including in neighboring Jordan. If you remember the bombings that happened at some of the hotels in Amman, I think they were in 2005. But they killed large numbers of civilians to such a degree that by 2006, a year before the surge, a year before the surge of American forces, we saw a major revolt by the tribes across Anbar province in Iraq. And this was really the beginning of al-Qaeda's difficulties in Iraq. They killed so many civilians, including Sunnis, that the local population in Anbar, especially the tribal sheikhs, the elders, revolted. And they took all of their forces that had collaborated with al-Qaeda, pushed them into the police forces in towns like Ramadi, and could provide intelligence on the location of these individuals, who they were, wire diagrams. So al-Qaeda, when it's adopted that kind of punishment strategy and killed civilians, has decimated itself. In that case, we've seen large-scale revolts among the population. So if the first issue is America's strategy, the second is al-Qaeda's, the third is the competence of local governance. And we've seen three sorts of local governance. One is we've seen governments that have been active allies of al-Qaeda. So if you go back to the 1990s in Afghanistan, the Taliban regime didn't just provide a sanctuary, it was an ally. During the famous 2002 Operation Anaconda, after the Taliban regime had been overthrown, a range of U.S., mostly U.S. special operations and intelligence operatives were hunting al-Qaeda in an area called the Shahikat Valley along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. What's interesting about that case, and this is, I think, gives us a sense of its relationship, actually even today of some of these groups, al-Qaeda was fighting directly with, hand-to-hand combat, with members of the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, and other organizations in that area. Its relationship was very close. It fought and died with a range of these Pashtun groups in this area. So there have been cases where al-Qaeda has a sanctuary and an ally. This is certainly a concern for Afghanistan down the line, in my view. The U.S. isn't careful. We've got the potential to walk right into something along these lines, because I don't think those relationships have ended. Second is we've had states and governments that have been weak and have been unable to defeat al-Qaeda within its borders. We're running into a problem in Yemen right now, where if you look at Yemen, the government has been affected by the Arab Spring. Its security forces have been involved in trying to establish control, regime control. It's got multiple insurgencies in the country. And al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, around the Gulf of Aden, have established a pretty notable foothold in several of the governorates there, including Shabwa, which are right along the Gulf of Aden, and they're the virtual equivalents of states here in the United States. So with weak central governments, and I'll come back to this with the Arab Spring in a moment, al-Qaeda has been able to establish footholds in some places. The third is we actually have had countries that have been fairly competent and strong and have been able to kick out al-Qaeda. One good example of that is in the 2003, 4, and 5 period in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi services decimated al-Qaeda across Saudi Arabia. So there certainly have been cases where you've had a competent government security services that have decimated the organization. So those three factors, I'll briefly walk through the waves and give you a sense of what's causing the rises and falls in them and then end by looking out over the next several years. The first wave, as I said earlier, leads up to about 2001, and it's partly a function of, I would say, a U.S. that doesn't actively get involved in countering al-Qaeda. It's a U.S. that it's an al-Qaeda that has an active sanctuary, and it's one that up until 2001 was very careful about who it killed. It did not kill large numbers of civilians. Then you get an effective targeting of the U.S., mostly by what I would call the light footprint approach, small numbers of CIA and U.S. special operations teams, both in Afghanistan but also in Pakistan. Then back at home, several plots that were very close to being executed. Majid Khan, Jose Padilla, who's captured in 2002 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport by FBI. FBI effectively using clandestine operatives, informants that was able to get into groups like the Fort Dix plotters or the Lackawanna group, that it was able to unfurl several of these major plots. Then you get, with the Iraq invasion, a second wave, probably to a major degree, the fact that al-Qaeda takes advantage of a large conventional presence. Now, with the weakening and then the collapse of the Iraqi regime, it has a sanctuary. And then the early part of that Iraq experience, it mostly targets embassies. The UN embassy kills the UN special representatives, targets the Jordanian embassy, targets American forces. That's generally, it doesn't get a lot of pushback for that. But then when it starts killing large numbers of Iraqis, Sunnis, Muslims, civilians, you get a major pushback. The U.S., in places like Anbar, resorts to a largely clandestine presence. Most of the pushback was done by clandestine agencies in Anbar province of Iraq. And so then it begins to lose that sanctuary. By 2008 and 9, we get another resurgence. Yeah, this is in an area mostly in Yemen where it gains sanctuary. The U.S. footprint increases, conventional footprint increases, especially in places like Afghanistan, which is used for propaganda purposes. So we're now at the end of that third wave. So I would say as we look at the future, the question for us here is what would it take for al-Qaeda to establish a fourth wave? And I'm going to argue that there are three factors along those same lines that would contribute to an al-Qaeda fourth wave. The first one would be a heavy footprint somewhere. If some future administration, the current one or a future one, decides to push in large numbers of conventional forces into a Muslim country, I think that's got the potential to increase the recruitment efforts against the United States by al-Qaeda. Certainly could lead to a range of individuals radicalizing, deciding to conduct attacks. So the footprint that the U.S. pushes overseas certainly appears to be one factor. There are a range of other, though, cases that are interesting and that don't indicate a large presence but would be an aggressive U.S. presence. So I'd ask this question. A U.S. or an Israeli attack against Iranian nuclear facilities, certainly plausible pattern. Certainly we've seen officials both in Israel recently talking about this. In magazines like Foreign Affairs, we saw last week or the week before former senior U.S. government officials advocating strikes against Iran. That might have interesting impacts on this. I mean, certainly we'd see al-Qaeda try to use this as an example of American aggression. I think they may be successful in trying to recruit some individuals. Again, I'm going to stay off for a moment whether it would be a good or a bad thing and just say, at the very least, we'd probably walk right into a major recruitment effort by al-Qaeda. Whether they'd be successful or not may be a separate question. But that would be one series, a major presence or an aggressive action in the Muslim world, certainly an overt one. There are plenty of covert actions going on, clandestine efforts in these countries. Most of them you'll never see, and that's done purposefully. I'm talking about an overt action like F-15 or F-16Is to target Iranian facilities, which will be picked up in the news. That's got, I think, the potential for, among other factors, for a resurgence. The second factor will be the Al-Qaeda in general. Now, an Al-Qaeda that decides that it's going to target civilians in a range of the countries we're talking about will be severely weakened, and it has been for that purpose. If what we see, though, is Al-Qaeda gets a little bit smarter in its Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan affiliates, and backs off on targeting the way the Taliban has done, for example, in Afghanistan, doesn't kill civilians or many of them, it has an ability, I think, potentially to garner more supporters, certainly not to lose many if it pursues that kind of a limited strategy. But again, what we've seen with Al-Qaeda over the last several years is it generally oversteps its boundaries. It generally, people like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq can't help themselves but to put bombs and target individuals in major squares, public locations where civilians are killed. And so in that sense, these are great opportunities to demonstrate, and we've seen a major pushback. Unfortunately, you don't see them in the American press. We've seen, with a lot of these civilian casualties that Al-Qaeda does, major pushbacks among Sunni conservative Muslims against Al-Qaeda. These acts are un-Islamic. Most Al-Qaeda leaders, including Zawahiri, have no Islamic training. That's a very interesting series of fights. Zawahiri in general, Al-Qaeda's number one, has gotten into very significant fights with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Hamas in the Palestinian territory, even the Egyptian Islamic Jihad over many of these issues. Public fights, not covered in the American press, but certainly covered across the Arab world. Those are very useful ones because what they do is show that part of this effort against Al-Qaeda is not about killing or capturing, or it's about a war of ideas. And they, so far, the last two or three years have been losing this. Public opinion polls show this. But again, we've seen them resurge from this. The third thing I'd say is takes me to the Arab Spring. And that is, many people have been very hopeful about the Arab Spring and issues of the increase in democracy across the Arab world. I'm going to argue that, in general, democracy is a good thing. From a national security perspective, I would argue if what we get out of that is weak, unstable regimes, and even it's not even clear in the countries we're talking about whether they will necessarily become more democratic or not. Will Egypt be more democratic? Looks like it, but we'll see. It's got a very strong, competent military now. Will it actually share power? What will the military's role be? Will it actually become democratic? Unclear. Yemen, will it have elections? Actually, that's very unclear right now. But what we've seen with Yemen is the Arab Spring has seriously weakened the regime to such a degree that it has allowed a range of global militant groups, including Al-Qaeda, to establish a foothold in wider tracts of land. So if what the Arab Spring ends up becoming 5 years from now or 10 years from now is a range of very weak regimes in key places, Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, where militant groups, including ones that are targeting the United States, gain a foothold, that's also got the possibility of a fourth wave. And I would say that's not in our interests. Certainly, if we can get strong, stable, democratic countries that come out of this, that would be in our interest. But that's very unclear right now. So for those people who continue to argue that the Arab Spring is a wonderful thing, I would say we'll see. 5 years, 10 years, we'll look back and say, look, it was a good stabilizing effort, or it was a very destabilizing one. That's unclear. So, in conclusion, what I'll say is that when we look at Al-Qaeda over the last 2.5 decades, again, we don't see a uniform, we don't see a uniform decline. So people have argued now that it's weak. I think when you look at it, you see that its weakness and strength have varied in a series of what I'll call waves. And right now, we're at the end, the ebbing of a third wave. A fourth wave will really be a function of what we do, what they do and what governments in key areas of the world do. And so whether or not this means the end of al-Qaeda, which I think it probably doesn't, will be a function of those three factors in combination. So hold on. This ride will take us through another 5 to 10 years at least. It's not over, I would say. And so in the question and answer session, we can, I'm sure we'll get to some of the specifics here. Thank you for spending some time.
Hey, Seth, thank you very much. That was fascinating. And I know we're going to have a lot of questions. We're probably going to run over, so we'll start very quickly. Let me see. Originally, al-Qaeda was staunchly anti-Shiite. It was certainly a Sunni organization. Is it still? What does this imply for us? Is it an opportunity to exploit the fact that it's Sunni and the Shiites could be used against it?
Very, very good question. Al-Qaeda's leadership is Sunni. I mean, its origins are in some of the key radical Sunni thinkers like Said Qutb, Abdul Assam, and its major affiliates are Sunnis. We've seen in Iraq that it has specifically targeted Shia. Okay, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2003 and 4 and 5 and 6 specifically made Shia a target equal to targeting American and Iraqi government forces. So with some of its affiliates, we have seen an active targeting of Shia. But what's interesting, and this also shows that there is not a uniform, al-Qaeda is not uniform along these lines, there were a series of captured documents that have now been declassified from al-Qaeda's senior leaders. Ayman al-Zawahiri wrote one. Atiyah Abdul-Rahman, who is the deputy general manager of al-Qaeda, wrote to Zarqawi saying, yes, the Shia are bad, but now is not the time to target them. You're actually hurting our cause by targeting the Shia now rather than helping it. So there's certainly been dialogue on what to do with the Shia, whether the time to target Shia is now or is later. The second part of this question, which makes it very interesting, is does anybody know after 2001, al-Qaeda's senior leadership, many of them went to Pakistan, but does anybody know where a notable chunk of them went as well? Iran, what's generally been called the Management Council. Several senior leaders went to Iran after the September. Some of them are still there today. Several key leaders, Saif al-Adl, Yasin al-Suri, are in Iran with what is likely has to be the knowledge of the Iranian government that I would say is being used as a wild card so that al-Qaeda isn't completely decimated by the U.S. So, again, there are some senior al-Qaeda leaders today. Now, the calculation here has got to be generally that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So I would say it's not an ideological sharing here, cooperation between a Shia Iranian regime and some al-Qaeda leaders in Iran. What it is convenience. Al-Qaeda's main target is the United States. Iran, one of its major enemies, is the United States. That has at least brought some of them together for now. So again, we do see several senior al-Qaeda leaders in Iran, and we have the Iranians letting them, in some cases under house arrest, but letting them stay in Iran now. It's a major wild card as we look at the future. This, I think, gives you a sense of the complexity in the Shia-Sunni relationship.
Okay, we're going to switch to Pakistan and al-Qaeda. And you know, I'll ask a couple of questions at the same time. Why does Pakistan apparently support al-Qaeda, at least passively? And as a follow-up, what would you recommend as the best U.S. policies towards Pakistan in the current situations? What should we be doing with Pakistan and al-Qaeda?
And you have the Pakistan ambassador coming. So
the other question I was going to ask as a follow-on that's here somewhere is, what question would you like to ask Ambassador Haqqani?
On the first one is on al-Qaeda and Pakistan government. I'll say this. The relationship between al-Qaeda and the Pakistan government, they've actually, if you look at over the last 10 years since 2001, the Pakistan government has been fairly helpful at capturing a number of senior al-Qaeda leaders. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, Ramzi bin al-Shib, Abu Faraj al-Libi. There are a number. Even recently, in 2009, the Najibullah Zazi plot in the U.S., which came a week and a half from being conducted. I mean, there was a National Security Agency intercept of an email a week and a half before the attack. His bombs had largely been built in Denver. He was driving from Denver to New York to conduct the attacks. He'd gone through training in Pakistan. He'd gone through training in Pakistan with al-Qaeda, had sat down with the head of external operations at the time, Salih al-Somali, and was ready to conduct. In fact, the intercept had said very clearly he was that the wedding was ready. I mean, most Americans, I don't think, realize how close we came to being attacked in 2009 in Times Square, in the New York City subway that was very close to the London attacks, a week and a half away to bombs that would have worked. The Pakistanis were actually helpful in arresting a range of the individuals from Pakistan involved in that that attack. Where the problem gets a little dicey, though, is, and U.S. officials have said this repeatedly, elements of the Pakistan government have provided assistance. And they may not acknowledge this publicly. They may say they don't do this. But again, I will say that the President of the United States has said this, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Director of Central Intelligence have said it publicly. Elements of the Pakistan government have provided assistance to some Afghan insurgent groups, the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Lashkar-e-Taiba, which was involved in the Mumbai attacks in India. In fact, in the trial in Chicago, you can actually see the ISI's role publicly in that from the trial. So the situation, I would say al-Qaeda, again, I don't know where, and I still think there's a lot of grayness on how much was known about bin Laden's whereabouts in Pakistan. But I think with al-Qaeda, they've generally been an enemy of the Pakistan state. But where this issue gets dicey again is militant groups that act as a proxy for the Pakistan state in India, in Kashmir, in Afghanistan. And in that sense, that's where a lot of the tension has arisen.
How about the question you would ask Haqqani if you were here in a couple of weeks? We'll make sure it's asked.
I'd actually like to hear from him what's from the Pakistan government side, because we've heard U.S. government officials say it. How, from the Pakistan side, what mistakes has it made in the past several years? Because I think the U.S. would admit several mistakes on how it's dealt with Pakistan. Publicly chastising them probably is not helpful in many cases. Some of the covert action the U.S. has done in people that have been captured, probably not helpful. Some of the drone strikes, including ones that have killed civilians, have generally tended to raise anti-Americanism. Be interested to see how the Pakistanis would evaluate their challenges with the American relationship. What have they done right, and what have they done wrong, and how do you correct that over the long run?
That's a great question. It's a great question.
But
all right, while we're still on Pakistan, besides the satisfaction, when you consider the decentralization of al-Qaeda, you're talking about, did the U.S. accomplish anything by killing bin Laden? And is there conceivably a downside by what we've done to our relationships with Pakistan? A
couple of things. One, on the upside, one of the things that, and there's been some information that's come out of the thumb drives that were captured after the bin Laden raid. It's been very clear in the public information that's been released that he definitely was involved in activities, at the very least at a strategic level. He was communicating regularly with al-Qaeda officials in Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, North Africa, obviously Afghanistan and Pakistan. So he did play an important role. He was a very important individual for the organization. He was a fighter. He fought in Afghanistan, unlike Zawahiri, who has been a thinker. He was a doer. Bin Laden was a doer. He was able, he was also a Saudi. The Egyptians have, in many cases, been lightning rods for parts of al-Qaeda. As a Saudi, someone from Mecca and Medina, the area where the Prophet came from, bin Laden also had an ability to pull together individuals like nobody else had. So that's the benefit of taking him off the battlefield, is that it takes off the most important individual, the creator of the organization, and it certainly disturbs its image for some period of time and its ability to operate and communicate with itself, because you've taken off its CEO. The downside is, among other things, you know, it's interesting, it certainly worsened the relationship with Pakistan. I mean, one of the problems that the that General Kiani faced within the Pakistan military is they said, you know, we wouldn't even think about it, I think, as we looked at the bin Laden raid. They said, well, if the Americans can do this, then the Indians certainly can do something along these lines. So how competent is our military if the Americans could come right in, conduct an attack, and leave without our awareness? What does it say about our military? And then it sort of fed into the drone strikes, which have contributed to some degree with anti-Americanism. There was a cost in doing it, too. I would say the benefits outweigh the costs in this case. Taking him off the battlefield was more helpful than it was harmful. Mm-hmm. But there were trade-offs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, staying on Afghanistan and Pakistan for a moment, as we withdraw, as the United States withdraw, do you think this will make al-Qaeda less interested in attacking the U.S. Or more interested?
Well, I think, first of all, I wouldn't look at Afghanistan out of context. Al-Qaeda's interest in targeting the U.S. homeland will also be a function of a range of other issues, what the U.S. is doing in Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, and other locations. But in the Iraq, I mean, in the Afghanistan context, if al-Qaeda is able to gain a foothold, and in areas like Kunar and Nangarhar provinces, we've seen a slight increase in al-Qaeda's activities in Afghanistan. If they're able to gain a foothold with groups or an eventual Taliban regime, I think it benefits them in the long run. Because, again, what we've seen is this organization, the Taliban, and many of its allies have willingly provided sanctuary to al-Qaeda. There have been some indications that they might think hard about not letting senior individuals senior al-Qaeda individuals into Afghanistan, but we've already seen a relationship that exists today. So I think a downsizing of American forces, a collapse of the Afghan government, and a Taliban, which has an alliance, and other groups who have an alliance with al-Qaeda, would not be in the U.S. interest. It doesn't have to go that way, mm-hmm. but a withdrawal, if that's what it led to, would, I think, be a strengthening for the organization.
Are you saying, then, that you don't think the Taliban has learned a lesson?
Correct.
Okay, so they would be perfectly willing under certain circumstances to invite al-Qaeda back.
They have had over two decades mm-hmm. of fighting with and establishing relationships. And again, this is not just the Taliban. We know mm-hmm. right now that one of al-Qaeda's strongest allies is an Afghan insurgent group whose name is the Haqqani Network. Mm-hmm. No relationship
right.
to the ambassador.
Right.
And they're actually co-located in parts of North Waziristan in Pakistan's tribal areas. That organization has links, very close links with al-Qaeda right now. They would certainly be part of any Taliban government. They're part of the inner Shura, Taliban's inner Shura right now. So, yes, I think the Taliban has not learned mm-hmm. that lesson, and certainly other groups have definitely not learned that lesson.
Since you mentioned the Haqqani group, there's a question about that, and that is, what is the relationship between the Pakistan government and the Haqqani group? Why won't they be more aggressive in terms of...
Well, this goes back to what we talked about earlier. The Haqqanis are an interesting case, because if you go back to the wars in the 1980s against the Soviet Union, one of the fairly competent Mujahideen fighters was a man named Jalaluddin Haqqani. He was one that the U.S. government and the Pakistanis, and the Saudis to some degree, provided assistance to. He was a very competent fighter against the Soviets. So we provided assistance. Well, Fast forward to today, he's now one of the most significant enemies of the United States, based out of North Waziristan in the tribal areas. And much like the Taliban, the Haqqani network, and this was something that the now former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said in a Senate, I think it was an Armed Services Committee testimony, he called it a virtual arm of the Pakistan government. I would say this, there is definitely a relationship between elements of the Pakistan government and the Haqqani network for proxy reasons. And that is, to think of this, there is a notable Indian presence in Afghanistan. In fact, Afghanistan's strongest regional ally, with whom it established a strategic partnership a couple of weeks ago, is India. So if you think of Pakistan for a moment, on one border it's got India, with whom it's fought several wars, and it's certainly got there have been some thaws, but it's an enemy. And on its other border, it's got an Indian, what it views as an Indian-Afghan axis. Well, India's got a much larger military, it's fairly competent, and so what Pakistan has done is it's provided assistance to what are called proxy organizations, including the Haqqani network, with an idea that at some point down the line, these groups can overthrow the Karzai regime and establish a friendly regime in Kabul, a friendly regime towards Pakistan, like it had in the 1990s. That's where the Haqqanis come in. So, again, this is an area where what diplomats will say publicly and what they do privately are two very different things. What I can tell you is what the Pakistan government may say publicly and what it does privately with the Haqqanis. Again, as we've seen, even the highest levels of the U.S. government say within the last several months are two different things.
Well, just as a follow-up to that on the Haqqani relationship with Pakistan, if that scenario worked out and the Haqqanis, their network, in fact, overthrew Karzai and ended up in power, what would their relationship with al-Qaeda be?
It appears to be quite close right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that that the de facto leader of the Haqqani network, Jalaluddin's son, his name is Siraj, has an active relationship with Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, Abu Yahya al-Libi, really the number two in al-Qaeda right now. There is a relationship. I just don't see, including from an ideological perspective, Siraj Haqqani talks about this sort of global jihadi stuff. They were involved in the attack against a CIA base in Khost province. The al-Qaeda was, to some degree, so were the Haqqanis. I just don't see, based on lots of evidence over the past two decades and recently, and their relationship right now, that that's going to change. So just to be clear about this, if you go back to the degrees of separation with Kevin Bacon, you have elements of the Pakistan government and the Haqqanis, and some senior al-Qaeda leaders. That's pretty close.
There was a question that I'd put aside, but I'll ask it right now. How high up in the Pakistani government do you think they were aware of Osama bin Laden's presence?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I will say this, though. For anybody, including myself, who's been to Pakistan, they've got a pretty competent intelligence service. They know when U.S. officials are there. They generally follow us. I would be surprised if someone didn't know. I don't know how high it went up. I don't know who knew and who didn't. But based on how competent they are in general and how much they are aware, I would be stunned if they didn't know.
Okay, one quick final up to that. With your experience within the American government, how well do interagency cooperations work these days abroad?
Well, they are better in some cases than others. I mean, on some issues, there's certainly a fair amount of good cooperation. But on others, hey, we have problems. I come from the special operations community. We have challenges with operating the conventional forces sometimes. When you get outside of the military, we've had plenty of challenges in working with the State Department. So, yes, we have plenty. If we had another hour, I'd be happy to give you details of
that. Right. Well, we'll definitely get you back for another hour sometime, Seth. It's been great. I really appreciate it. They were great, great questions, but really terrific answers. And as a reward, the famous Midcoast Farm on Foreign Relations mug.
I've heard of this. This is a thank you. Thank you very much.
That's great. That's great.
Fantastic questions. Here it is.